titled The Future of Judaism. I'm Dr. Elliot Malamud. I wanted to introduce on my, starting from my extreme left, the original graphical sketch of speakers, since all of you had the opportunity to hear those this morning. Rabbi Cardozo is a prolific author of many books and is putting out two more in the coming year. To his immediate right is Rabbi Yaakov Yosef Reinman of Beit Medrash Gavoa in Lakewood, New Jersey, who's the author of many Svarim on contract law, as well as the book One People, Two Worlds, of which he spoke of this morning. To my immediate right is Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, the Chancellor of University. Those of you who heard his keynote address are well aware of were outlined prior to his speech. And he's also the author of numerous focused on Torah Umada. Extreme right is Rabbi Sachi Shul in London, England, who is currently engaged in a scholarly biography of Rabbi Yosef Sapochnik, who's going to be published by Oxford University Press in the year 2006. I'm going to take the fall for this immediately. This was all my idea. So if you like it, you can lay the blame. At my doorstep, I wanted to, when I invited all these gentlemen to come to Toronto, to create the kind of dialogue that I think is rarely seen these days in the Jewish world and certainly the world, to talk about the issues that are pressing and of concern to us. And I think those issues are, they require serious thought, they require reflection, and they require courage. And so I wanted to put some of those out today. And of course, after they have finished exhausting what we can in the time allotted, welcome to ask questions. I put down some questions for myself as a kind of guideline to what I wanted to do. And so I'm going to begin with those, and everybody can jump in. I want to begin just with a 15-second anecdote, which will be a prelude to the first question, which is that a student of mine a few years ago complained to me that people within Orthodoxy have ceased to communicate to him about anything that really touches him on a deep level, not to mention to respect and validate his vantage point as a modern person. He says that all he hears is halachic minutiae and fear of the world. Now, everybody has their own vantage point. He had his own issues. I don't take his statements to be the gospel truth, but I found it provocative. And it leads me to my first question, which is, has halachic Judaism become too insular, too cut off from the concerns and sensitivities of all Jews, not to mention the non-Jewish world? And what I really wanted to know, such insularity necessary for the survival of Torah Judaism? Is it intrinsic to the halachic system, or is it really an excuse for an inability or unwillingness to engage with the world? This morning we heard various viewpoints of all of these gentlemen who seem to not have total agreement on the questions as I've stated them. So I wanted to put those out to whoever would like to jump in first. Again, has halachic Judaism become too insular, too cut off from the concerns of all Jews, and even more so non-Jews? Go ahead.
Okay. Dr. Malamud says that he's the centrist. That puts me left of center and Dr. Lamb right of center.
I'm glad you agree I was right.
And Rabbi Donner is extreme right. Anyway.
What are you going to say? Wait till you see.
The rest they can figure out.
Thanks.
Okay. I don't think that halachic Jewry, Orthodox Jewry, is incapable of... that was when I did my book. People were saying that. And one of the myths that I hope I exploded with the book is that we are perfectly capable of engaging other views. The issue is not our inability. We are... classical halachic Judaism is intellectually very powerful, and there are numerous people in the Orthodox community. I suppose if we're talking over here about not the modern Orthodox, we're talking about more the classical Orthodox community, the Haredi world. There are numerous people that are very much open to the world, among the rabbis, among the lay people, who are professionals, who have a tremendous knowledge of the world. The question is what the values are. And the Haredi world does not feel that it is important as part of the chinuch of our children, to expose them to everything in the world. Because you know, you're taking a very high risk. Let them expose them to Torah, to teach them as much, you know, a good grounding in secular knowledge. And as they grow older, let them make their own decisions. If they want to explore the secular world, it's there to be explored. I explored it. I still explore it. Many other people do it. And it's fine. But not everybody is capable of doing it. And there are many people that just need to lead an uncomplicated life and not to get involved in all kinds of questions, to have a very strong emunah and to learn Torah and do mitzvahs, have a good relationship with the Rabbi Nishloilam. And you don't need to open up Pandora's boxes for everyone. Individuals are free to do whatever they want to, and numerous people do.
Any other thoughts here?
I'll step in. I come from probably the same Haredi world as Rabbi Reinman, but I would say that all communities are insular, not just in the Jewish world, by the way. Across the world, every community in the world thinks that what they're doing is right and what everyone else is doing is wrong. I used to talk to large groups of potential Balei Tshuva from all walks of Jewish life, and I used to say that every Jew believes that anyone who's frommer than them is a fanatic, and anyone who's less from than them is a goy. And I think it's true across the Jewish world. It doesn't really matter which community you come from. Having said that, I think that the rosy picture that Rabbi Reinman paints is misleading, because whilst practically speaking, the barriers put up in front of people who want to, for example, go to university, are very strong. They're barriers like shidduchim, barriers like being part of a community, the type of internal pressures that exist in a Jewish community, for example, not being able to get your children into school if you associate with certain people or write certain articles. I think that type of communal pressure, which is not overt and certainly nobody writes about and it doesn't appear publicly, is a type of pressure that creates a feeling of fear, which creates total insularity. So whilst on an individual ad hoc basis there are those like Rabbi Reinman and like myself, I went to university and somehow I did get married. It was a miracle. But
Does your wife think
so? Well, you have to ask her. She's just over there. But it's very unusual. I studied Jewish history and I still remember bringing my dissertation to my esteemed grandfather, who's the head rabbi of the Haredi community in London. And he looked over it. It was about the Dead Sea Scrolls. And he said, I see that you've quoted the New Testament. He said, once I understand, 17 times? So you have to understand that there is a certain element of damage that comes about from the insularity. And I don't think that as much as Rabbi Reinman would tell you that it's important, and across the Haredi world, this is the line that you toe, that it's important to build a relationship with the Rabbeinu Shlomo and to learn Torah, and everything else that happens, well, it will happen, we'll see. You know, you'll make your own way. It's not a practical arrangement, ultimately, for numerous reasons, which I'm sure I don't have to enumerate, but it's damaging because it prevents people from exploring the Rabbeinu Shlomo in a way which is beyond their own community. Halacha and the community shouldn't become the God. Ribbono Shel Olam is the God. Not halacha, not community, not the place where you live, not the school you send your children. The Ribbono Shel Olam is the Ribbono Shel Olam, and ultimately that's the direction we should all be heading towards. And I fear that people like Eliot's student, who see in the Torah world insularity, they may like Rabbi Reinman, they may like the Torah world, but they see it as an other world, as a world that doesn't attract them, however beautiful it may be for the people inside it. And therein lies the danger.
Yes, I think the answer to my answer to the question, are they too cut off from the modern world? The answer is yes. They are too cut off. I'll come back to it in a moment. Well, let me come back to it right now. You know, if you raise a child in what was once called the Skinner box, so there was a psychologist that wanted to raise a child in a completely isolated vacuum or a box, so it have no contact with germs, et cetera, et cetera. That's the best way to contract a fatal illness. because if you have no, if you're not immunized against all the bugs and microbes and et cetera in the world, not only bugs and microbes, but people and their attitudes, then you're at mercy of these very, very people you wanted to keep away from. I'll give you an example. The super frum community of Spring Valley, Muncie. Many of the people are in the diamond business, and they have a bus that goes into the diamond district on 47th Street. They daven mincha when they come back, and they come back on the same bus. They never really interact with the world. They interact with each other. The Chaim of the Sholem, they have a diamond deal. It's very lovely people. The wives, however, and the young women do go into the world as secretaries generally. They get jobs in various firms. The result is that the women are exposed to the world, the men are not. And someone who knows this community very, very well from a professional point of view said that it is the cause of a great deal of marital unhappiness, including divorce. The women see their husbands, they may be very frum, they may be very good, but they see them as unworldly, and that ignorant of the world, and it just doesn't mix. There's just too much of a difference between one and the other. Now, it seems to me that the answer, therefore, has to be nuanced. To a certain extent, you're right. I agree with Rabbi Dana. Every community has to have its own structure and keep away strangers, especially from young children as they grow up. I would not expose young children to everything that adults do. But at one point, I just refuse to make a virtue out of ignorance. And I think it's important that we do interact with the world, and we do train young people coming into the age of maturity, who they are, what they are, and let them know how to grapple with the world about them, because they're going to, unless they want to grow up in Muncie or Bnei Brak or Monroe, they're going to have to live with other people, and it's best that they do so and prepare for it when they're young.
Far be it for me to need to defend Rabbi Ryman, who's amply capable of defending himself, but to be perfectly honest, there are points that he made there that I, on the other side of my brain, am completely sympathetic to. And I'm going to pose a question actually to Rabbi Cardoza on the basis of this. Rabbi Ryman pointed out that the issue of exposure, the issue of not every child being able to handle exposure, and of course this is a highly subjective category, what is it that you can expose a child to? But as somebody who's worked a very long time with teenagers and college students, I do know what exposure can mean, and exposure can be disastrous. And what I'm curious about is that when we in the modern Orthodox world like to talk about integration, we like to talk about Torah Mada, I for a long time have been trying to see where my students are actually combining Torah Mada. And here's the Torah Mada that they combine. They combine a certain amount of Torah learning, some of it passionate and some of it utterly passionless, with their version of Mada, which is trash television. Literature, if they read it at all, is trash. A great deal of fooling around on the internet, a great deal of deification of sports figures, a great deal of very corrosive values. In other words, I think there has to be honesty on the other side too. I'm not sure that most people do have a, quote, nuanced version of Torah in the modern world. And I think it's a very significant and legitimate question to pose. How do you teach that kind of nuance? And should we, I think, err on the side of caution? Err on the side of, so a little less exposure, but also a little less flight from traditional Judaism. So I'm wondering if you could address that.
Well, it's a complicated story, this, but I would agree in principle there are many things which are called modern or modern Orthodox or modernity, which has nothing to do with what Rabbi Lam has in mind. We are speaking about the intellectual life and the spiritual life in combination with the Jewish tradition. I don't know if I belong to the Haredi world or the modern Orthodox world, and I will not be able to make up my mind. I'm one leg here and one leg there.
Depends
I don't.
Depends on what you say today.
I don't have television at home because I don't see any advantage in having this at home and exposing my children or my grandchildren to this. I don't want them to read certain kinds of literature which are low and trash and don't have any value as such. What I object against in the Haredi world is no doubt that on the other side, they cut them off from important and real information which they need in life. And as I said also this morning to those people who were here, you need challenges to appreciate the Jewish tradition. And if you create a situation in where there is no challenge at all because everything is worked out for you and you're living in that little world, and it is absolutely true that the Haredi world is creating that kind of world, then you're paying the price on the other side. You have indeed to find this kind of balance. I must say here, in the question which you asked before, when we speak about halachic Judaism, which is a very broad word, I don't know exactly what you mean by that. If we look into the Haredi world, I think we have a major problem there, that there is an obsession with halacha for the sake of halacha, in the sense that everything is brought down to purely an halachic way of behavior. If you follow the Mishnah Berura properly and Shulchan Aruch properly, then you are a good Jew. What we are losing here, and this is the reason why there are a tremendous amount of dropouts today in the Haredi world, is that we don't teach a mission. We don't teach something about the universality of the Jewish tradition, about what it is that we stand for. We have to be an Amsugula, we have to be an Orla Goyim. All these matters are no longer discussed because we have indeed insulated ourselves so much that the non-Jewish world, for a great extent, no longer exists, and there's nothing which we have to tell them, or we have basically given up on them and say there's no point in even discussing them, they're all anti-Semitic, so what is the point in doing that? Against that I object. On the other side, the modern Orthodox world has a problem, and I've discussed this also with Rabbi Lam before, is that halacha is not always taken seriously enough. There's too much shopping going on about halachic heterim, finding this rabbi for this heter and this particular rabbi for that heter. There's also a lack there of mission in that sense of the word. So indeed, what I would like to see is, how to do this I don't know, is that the Haredi mind on one side and the Orthodox, modern Orthodox mind, they will actually meet and discuss this and learn from each other or what there is to learn. There's a lot to learn from both these facts. There's an issue here of Yirat Shamayim. I think there's a problem on both sides of the spectrum, which we have to bring back again. But children and young people are never motivated unless there is a larger mission beyond the little community in which you live. And we are losing this, specifically in the Haredi world. But I must say, I think there's something else in the modern Orthodox world. Loads of people, including Rabbi Lam, are writing on these very important topics and writing incredibly important stuff, which is not read by the modern Orthodox. It is read by a very small amount of people, but the rest has no connection with it. So even those who are calling themselves modern Orthodox have no idea what it means to be a modern Orthodox, and because of that, they pay the price as well.
Can I just say one more thing? No, I just want to make one more point, that Rabbi Cardozo speaking about the Haredi world, you have to understand that there's a very big difference between the Haredi world in Israel and the Haredi world in America. In Israel, there are absolutely no secular studies. Child starts, it's all Torah from the time a child enters school all the way through. In America, you go to elementary school, you go to high school, you get a broad knowledge, you're open to the newspapers. There's a much greater awareness of the world in the American Haredi community than in the Israeli community. Even in Lakewood, I go to the Yeshiva Lakewood, there are many people in Lakewood that go on to become lawyers, they get their degrees from the Yeshiva, and they go on to law school with that. And they're fine, they're part of the community, there are doctors, there are lawyers, there are people that go into the sciences and the computer sciences, and you know, it's very acceptable here. Whereas in Israel, it's a totally different situation. So I think a lot of what Rabbi Cardozo was saying was covered by his personal experience with the Israeli Haredi world.
Yes.
We welcome you to the American Haredi world.
Thank you. Let me add to this one point. I agree with that. There is definitely a distinction between what happens here in America and what happens in Israel. It is more problematic in Israel, no doubt. But I would say something else. We are just speaking about science, about professionals, about people like that. But what we really are not doing, and definitely not in the Haredi world, and only to a certain extent, and in very small, limited form in the modern Orthodox world, we don't deal with ideological issues, with philosophical issues, with theological issues. And be aware that it is there that our young people ask questions.
Well, we deal with them in the context of Torah.
Yeah, but you have to understand, many people who are coming from a larger world, have read so many things which are not kosher, if that's the right word. We have to respond on that, and we can only do that when we know what these non-kosher authors are saying.
So that is really the function of outreach people.
It's not just a matter of outreach.
Or people that are involved.
Even when it is outreach, and then I would say straight away, and I've been involved in outreach for many years, is that the response given in general by the outreach is simplistic. It is not well thought through. They don't know their sources, and therefore, straight away, they come up with answers, which I then, or I'm sure us as well, we get then afterwards people claiming, well, what they are telling us in this outreach program, we know it is not true because the scientific information is not correct, or the philosophical information is not correct. And by that, we create a Chilul Hashem. Okay. For the same reasons, we could have straightened it out.
Can I just add something here? Rabbi Reimer just said something very interesting. He said that all those outreach people do it. See, I think that's one of the problems in the Haredi world, that the only reason that anybody would learn a theological, I mean, you said it yourself this morning in your talk, the only reason you got to know about certain subjects is because you had to reply to Amiel Hirsch in a series of emails. Otherwise, it's not important.
But actually,
it is important.
That's not what I said. I said that there are issues of Abuna that I brought up here which are not issues to me. But since I spent my whole life learning Torah, I don't have a problem with Tamnash HaMachnoi, and I don't have to think into it, and doesn't raise questions of my Amunah. Whereas other people who are coming from a different background, they learned this Gemara, they say, my children won over me, and all of a sudden they've got all kinds of questions. So I never had to learn that the way I learned
but
other
it, but it doesn't have to be dealt with in the form of questions.
To respond to them.
But it doesn't have to be dealt with in the form of questions. Some information, some knowledge, is valuable in and of itself. Not because it's a response to some question that a reform rabbi is going to ask you, or some outreach, you're going to be involved with some youngster in an outreach organization. It's important in and of itself.
I've read plenty of philosophy and literature and science before I got to this book. But what I was speaking about was specifically to deal with the type of distortions.
But is the philosophy that you read part of the curriculum at Lakewood Yeshiva? No, it isn't.
No, I don't think it should be.
I understand because you think it's.
I think
not
those
important.
People who have an interest should read it. I think most people do not have an interest. So why make them read?
Would the rabbis?
People that
would
open
the
up
rabbis
endorse and go,
the same rabbis who criticized your book? Would they be willing to come out with a statement to endorse Haredi people reading philosophy?
They do.
I understand, but would they endorse
they
it
do.
Publicly?
No.
Ah, there you go.
Because they're not recommending it to the public. But they do.
But why would they not recommend it to the public
because it's not something that should be recommended across the board to the public, that everybody should start reading Kant. Why should they read Kant?
Why not?
Because it's valuable information,
why shouldn't they read
it? They won't understand them anyway. I spent my whole life understanding them.
I tried and I can't.
I'd like to jump in just for a second because there's something that you raised that I think is very important and I had a lot of difficulty with. When you're talking about Kiruv, you're talking about outreach, and I and many others have been engaged in this work for many years. And I think the attitude that you posited was that if people who are far away from Torah, quote unquote, want to get legitimate views, well, there are all these sort of Kiruv organizations, they can get them from that. And you use that as a sort of buttress for an argument of trying to create a kind of separation between Orthodox rabbis and Reform rabbis. They shouldn't meet in any official way. And I have to tell you, quite frankly, that on a practical level, I find this utterly ludicrous. As if the secular world, as if all the assimilated students that I've taught, and we're talking about thousands now, throughout all of these years, are running to Kiruv organizations and running to outreach conferences and running to Orthodox rabbis to be educated. Is the attitude here basically, if they don't come to me, if they don't read me, they're lost? Or should our attitude be, in my opinion, we have to go out there and we have to actually communicate with these people, and if it means communicating to them on their turf, then so be it. Because to me, the alternative is to write off the generation, which I'm not willing to do. Not everybody is going to read your book. Not everybody is going to email you. Not everybody is going to come to Lakewood or Esha Torah or Sameach. What do we do with these people?
Heaven forbid to write off those people. Heaven
but
forbid.
Practically speaking,
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying you have to think of ways to reach them. But if you're going to reach them by validating their rabbis and muddying that line of division and saying that it's possible that this is also a rabbi and this is also interpretation of Judaism, then by going out to save them, and not only aren't you saving them, you're destroying your own.
Excuse me, when did disagreement becoming muddying the lines of division? If I say something and you radically disagree with me, is anybody going to think that the lines of division are blurred here?
This is a big mistake within the, in my opinion, the Haredi world. The fact that we are not prepared to speak to the Reform and the Conservative, first of all, it only shows that we are afraid of them, which is the first mistake. because it makes the impression, and that happened with your book as well, we wrote about it together. The fact is that the moment that we take something back which we already have done, or we don't want to engage in a discussion with them, means to say we are afraid. Rabbi Lam, in his book Torah Umada, has a Maharal over there, where the Maharal says exactly the reverse, that one should speak with these people, listen to their arguments. And I would say something else as well. I learn a lot from reading Reform and conservative stuff. Why? Because their critique on me, on the Orthodox perspective, helps me to formulate it better. It has helped me tremendously in my Baal Teshuvah days when I had to work within that particular world. And to cut me or anybody off from this kind of dialogue, even when I don't believe for one moment that we will ever come to a conclusion with the Reform and the Conservative, we have grown too far away from each other. But not to listen to them, not to hear what they argue, and how to articulate ourselves better afterwards.
I'd like to continue that, Maharal. Not only does he say you should speak to them, but he says two things. Number one, speak to them civilly, and speak to them by thinking about what they say. What I hear from Rabbi Ryman is that we are coming from above to below and give them the impression that we are the teachers and we have the truth, now we're going to give it to you poor savages and civilize you. Almost like we have those missionaries in China. No, the Maharal says, listen, and what Rabbi Cardoza is saying, listen carefully to what they say, don't formulate your answers before they ask the question, and then respond to them. It's a very courageous thing for the Maharal and his generation, Vaharaya, that in our generation, several hundred years later, we still haven't done it. But there is, what bothers me about a good part of outreach is that the assumption is that I'm going to give you all the answers. You know, I don't have all the answers. You don't have all the answers. And a little bit modesty, I think, will go a long way in convincing people.
Yeah, I have to tell you that the Maharal was not contending with alternate rabbinates. There were no alternate rabbinates in his time. There were apikarsim, and fine.
You know, Rabbi, let me interrupt you.
No, you can speak to the apikarsim, and you can listen to what they have to say, and you should listen to what they have to say. When I wrote my book, when he sent me a letter, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking about it and studying and coming up with answers, and I definitely think there's a great value. I felt as a result of my book that my own emunah was very much strengthened because I dealt with issues that I hadn't dealt with before because they weren't my sugyas.
But that is not the attitude of the Haredi world. Vaharaya, the majority of your people made you eat crow on that.
Can I ask you a question? Would you agree with everything that Rabbi Lam says?
At what?
Generally, do you agree with his position?
Recap it for me.
I had one of my members in my shul said after my drushes, it's all one drusha, be good.
would you say that your position on this platform validates his position that he mentioned upstairs? Generally, all the Torah, Madah, whatever position Rabbi Lam takes.
I don't agree with that.
So how come you're sitting on the same platform?
Because Rabbi Lam is an Orthodox Jew. Because he believes in Torah min Hashemayim, because he believes that there's a covenant between the Rosh Hashanah.
But you're validating his position.
No, I don't agree that every time you fight, we argue with somebody, you validate his position.
So therefore,
I do validate Rabbi Lam, that Rabbi Lam is a rabbi. So I have no problem sitting.
We have all of this on tape. I want you to know.
What number smicha is that?
I better stop here. So by sitting on the same platform with Rabbi Lam, even though I may disagree with him very strongly on many of his views, but I do agree that he is a rabbi and he has smicha and he's a good Jew. Whereas if I'm sitting with a Reform rabbi who denies Torah min Hashemayim, who says that the whole Torah is a myth, who says that there is no covenant, then if I sit with it, how can I in any way validate his being a rabbi? How can I address? Do you know when I wrote my book, it's written in my contract that neither of us can be called rabbi on the cover. And he understood it. I mean, he understood. Because I don't consider him a rabbi. What makes him a rabbi?
What makes him a rabbi?
You want to call him sir? I'll call him sir. But rabbi? So that's the problem. The problem is here we're dealing with rabbinate. We're dealing with the impression that there are different streams of Judaism, that there are different flavors of the same product. And it is not true.
Rabbi Ryan.
I'm not saying so that, but there are problems that you need to come up, how to solve them, but that is...
You had the courage to write this book, right? On the end of the day, all the people who at the beginning were in favor of it...
I'm still in favor of it.
are not anymore in favor of it because they walked out on you. Exactly for this reason.
They defer to the majority in public, and so do I, but I'm very happy about the book, and so are they. That's all.
Then they should have left it in the bookshelf.
It's a certain logic.
It's political issues.
Certain kind of logic.
Well, that's bad enough.
I wanted to just draw off of something that all of you were talking about, which is this business of legitimacy of non-Orthodox movements. I thought you actually put it very well there, that for you there's a kind of dividing line. There's a dividing line of certain theological principles, certain halachic principles that you have to accept to Amin Shamayim, that you're saying that you accept, if one can use the word in quotation marks, a certain pluralist view within Orthodoxy as long as there are certain lines drawn, and you won't go further than that. So I want to read to you, all of you, a quote that I find personally fascinating, and I think is very provocative. It's by the late Rabbi Dr. Eliezer Berkovitz, who writes the following in one of his essays. Quote, although Orthodoxy maintains halakha as divine, it is still, after all, a personal belief. No matter how convincing our reasons and our proofs for the faith may be for us, they still will be no more than reasons and proofs for us. End quote. In other words, isn't our worldview just a subjective belief? We believe it with all our heart and soul, but it's a belief. If so, how can we condemn others for their subjective views and not want to speak to them?
Let me say one thing. I'm a great admirer of Eliezer Berkowitz. This line I can't follow, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
It doesn't make sense. What he is saying is that on the end of the day, all is up in the air, and it's all a matter of doubt, right?
It's a matter of opinion.
A matter of opinion. Just because of the fact that something is a matter of opinion, I am not prepared to give up my life for this.
Okay.
But if it is the truth, I am, right? And Jews throughout the whole of history have given up their lives for Torah Min HaShamayim, and now to bring it back like Berkowitz does over here, once more with the greatest amount of respect, of saying it is just a belief like everybody else has got to believe, I don't think that is acceptable.
Why not?
Because it means to say that I have to live a life, right? I'm asked to give up my life for that, and I'm not even 100% sure that it is something worthwhile to give my life up for.
You're not 100% sure that it's true, and isn't that reality?
No, there's a big difference here.
I'm going to follow that up.
Now they can all jump on me.
Very lovely victim. In a sense, every belief is subjective. Every belief is subjective. Whether I believe in demons and fairies and angels flying around, or whether I believe that there is a God in the world, or I believe that I'm here sitting in Toronto, Ontario. Any belief is by nature subjective. But there are beliefs that refer to the objective world, and as Rabbi Cardoza says, are so deeply held that I'm ready to sacrifice my life for it. I'm not willing to sacrifice my life to say that I.B. Singer was right, that there are demons running around all over the place. But I am willing to sacrifice my life for Torah Min HaShamayim, for the Achdus of Am Yisrael, for Eretz Yisrael. These are things that are terribly important. That kind of belief cannot be dismissed as merely subjective, because then the belief that I exist, look, my take it on a philosophical level, the belief that I see people in front of me, is the idealist and the realist.
That's a belief.
Yeah, of course. I also dismiss that as merely a subjective impression on my brain, which is not too good in the first place. So therefore, I can't use that line of argument. It doesn't go. The question is, how seriously do I take my beliefs? Now, my argument with Rabbi Ryman is, forgive me for saying this, I think is caught in a time warp of the 1950s, which is over as Marek Boto. Frankly, Rabbi Ryman, the Reform rabbis don't give much of a care whether you recognize them or not.
I do care.
The human beings. Many of them are sincere human beings. Many of them have an amuna which is as strong as their amuna as I have for mine. I don't agree with it, but it doesn't mean I can't relate to them as responsible, mature, and people of independent thinking. I don't agree with them. I profoundly disagree with many things they say. But so what? It doesn't mean I have to just throw them away. Now, I therefore am in a situation where, let me tell you, I wrote an article a number of years ago. You say, are they legitimate and not legitimate? Then you said, are they legitimate and are they valid? I make a distinction between legitimate and valid. Legitimate comes from the word L-E-G-E, whatever it is in Latin, which means law. Legitimate is something which accords with the law. They do not accord with the law. The law is halacha. They are not, in my mind, legitimate.
but they are valid. Validus comes from the word validus, which means strong, powerful. They are a very powerful Jewish movement. They are larger than we are, and although most of their people are not that interested in Judaism, we aren't all perfect too, except for Lakewood. We're not perfect too. When we have more strength in Amunah, fine. But they are valid, and therefore I'm willing to deal with them no less than I deal with the president of the American Jewish American Jewish Committee, or with the head of the ADL. The fact that they have no or do have an ordination doesn't bother me because I don't accept it anyway. So I will recognize them as leaders of the Jewish community. They are leaders of their community. I love Jews, and therefore I respect them in that way. Don't accept them as legitimate, because I don't recognize them as having smicha.
Rabbi Lamb, would you appear on a panel with Jews for Jesus?
With Jews for Jesus?
Yeah.
No way.
No?
They're
valid.
No.
You're using a Latin definition of strength?
No, no. I think if they
have a court, the same way millions of followers?
Same way as the Supreme Court of Israel, when it came to the brother David, was it called? Brother something or other, Daniel, said that, you know, here we don't go to halacha, we go beyond halacha. Beyond halacha. According to halacha, there's nothing wrong. He believes that he was a Mashiach. Big deal. But there are certain things that go beyond halacha. And there I agree with Rabbi Cardoza. We mix too much. We're too technologically oriented towards halacha. There are things that go beyond it. Beyond it is, if you believe in Jesus, then speaking to people who have grown up in a heavily Christian milieu for the last 2,000 years, 1,800 years, then you're outside the machana. I don't regard them as Jewish. Halachically, I do.
Okay.
But personally, I don't.
Can I say something?
Pardon?
Yes. The difference for me is where you draw the red line. You draw it by Jews for Jesus. I draw it a little bit closer. I draw it by Torah and Hashemite.
If some of your friends draw it closer, keep me out, too.
Okay. Anyway, listen.
Excuse me, some of them would keep him out as well.
Listen, okay. I just want to speak about this, about the original question.
Yes.
By the way, just what you were saying about the 1950s, Rabbi Soloveitchik also was against any contact, the dialogue, which is of an ideological nature.
The article was written in 1950.
Okay. What has changed?
What has changed?
We have cell phones.
You know why? I'll tell you
cell
why.
Cell phones and fax machines.
No. That's cheap.
The world
that's
has deteriorated.
No.
Okay, but listen, let me just go.
Let me just finish the world. I got to this thing itself. In those days, the Reform and Conservative rabbis were graduates of yeshivas. Now they come from the outside coming in.
You have a better memory of those days than I do, so I really won't argue.
I was around. You weren't around yet.
you got smicha in 51. Yeah. In 51, where was I? Anyway, I want to go to the original point of the personal belief. I've also read Berkowitz, and I definitely do not agree with that line. Now, this morning, I'm not going to go through everything again, but I spoke about very much the idea of a national memory. We know the most valid way of having a knowledge of something is through memory. Evidence can always be disputed. You bring me a photograph, I'll tell you about Photoshop. There are people that dispute the Holocaust. They deny the Holocaust. Evidence can always be disputed, but memory cannot. So I remember something cannot. The reason why we believe in Torah and Shemayim is not because we have objective, rational proofs, but because it's part of our national memory. I don't want to go into this at length
now.
Obviously,
I haven't heard of false memory syndrome. I mean, it's absurd to me to say that one is true and one is not.
Oh, there are people that have faulty memories, but we're talking about millions of people having the same faulty memory. That's really not something that happens. So it's not a personal belief. It's not. It's something that is part of our collective memory.
Let's move on. I'm going to say beforehand that I, if I had more time, I radically don't agree with all four of you. And,
I haven't
and,
said anything.
And, no, you were nodding. You were nodding. I think his point can actually be made very strongly. But I want to move on to something within Orthodox Judaism that I think is very, very crucial. It seems to me, in listening to, reading all of your work, and speaking to many, many people over the years, that Orthodox Judaism, and I think all of us would really agree with this, in a very real sense, comes down to investing in the authority of Chazal. In other words, a kind of lived Judaism that comes off of the Talmud and the Poskim. To interpret the Torah and frame halakha for Jewry. I'm wondering what happens when we feel Chazal are wrong, and I mean that in different kinds of senses. What happens when they're wrong in a factual sense? In other words, certain kinds of scientific formulations that are clearly debunked later on. What happens if we feel they're outdated in a sociological sense? Certain attitudes, let's say, to women's intellectual capacity, and These are things that not everybody may agree with, but I'm throwing it out for discussion. Does this undermine their authority? In other words, what about the modern who comes up and says, you know what, I see that much of halakha is framed around the mindset of the Gemara, and obviously the Orthodox viewpoint is this is not something that they're inventing, but simply recording from Sinai. But if they're wrong or human, why do we have to listen to them? Is it because of what the Ramban says in, you know, Parshat Shoftim about Lo Tasur Yamin Ushmal, a political dimension? In other words, you have to listen to them because one Torah otherwise will become many Torot. If so, if it's a political dimension, what does that say about our claim to truth? Right?